Would you repeat Tehran?
Feeling frustrated and stressed out, Brazilians have found a place to vent their anger and fury in the newly opened Rage Room. Inside a warehouse on the outskirts of Sao Paulo, people can freely swing giant hammers at old televisions, computers and printers. Demolishing the machines and shattering glass into tiny pieces helps to release their pent-up feelings. The 42-year-old who opened the business a month ago says he has received a fair number of customers wanting to vent, especially during the pandemic.
I think it was the best moment to be able to set this up here, related to everything that people are going through. A lot of anxiety, stress. Sometimes people miss work or even work a lot at home. I believe this here is like an escape at the moment.
Wearing protective suits and helmets, participants write issues that bother them on the walls, turning the words into targets of their anger. One might think how much it costs to break all these things up. The Rage Room experience, however, costs just less than $5.
Tens of thousands of flamingos have turned the Indian city of Navi Mumbai pink. Bird lovers gathered near a lake to watch the migrating flamingos. Every year, flamingos migrate to Navi Mumbai between October and March. They go there from northern and western parts of India and sometimes as far away as Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran. Then they fly out in June. This year and last year, their numbers were much higher. Experts say that is because the lake is cleaner thanks to COVID lockdowns.
That's a wrap-up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَجَاهِدُوا فِي اللَّهِ حَقَّ جِهَادٍ وَاجْتَبَاكُمْ وَمَا جَعَلَ عَلَيْكُمْ فِي الدِّينِ مِنْ حَرَجٍ مِلَّةَ أَبِيكُمْ إِبْرَاهِيمَ
وَأَقِيمُوا الصَّلَاةَ وَآتُوا الزَّكَاةَ وَاعْتَصِمُوا بِاللَّهِ هُوَ مَوْلَاكُمْ فَنِعْمَ الْمَوْلَى وَنِعْمَ النَّصِيرُ.
And strive for Allah with the striving due to Him. He has chosen you and has not placed upon you in the religion any difficulty. It is the religion of your father, Abraham. Allah named you Muslims before in former scriptures, and in this revelation that the messenger may be a witness over you, and you may be witnesses over the people. So establish prayer and give zakah and hold fast to Allah. He is your protector, and excellent is the protector, and excellent is the helper.
Dear listeners, we're now into the 78th verse, the last verse of Surah Al-Hajj. And you may remember that in the previous program, with regard to the 77th verse, we also mentioned that these two verses, these two ending verses, are actually addressing the believers and are actually stating some general and inclusive instructions if they are to protect their religion. And by listening and observing these rules and instructions, they will be successful in all circumstances. And this is somehow the conclusion of Surah Al-Hajj. The 78th verse starts saying, وَجَاهِدُوا فِي اللَّهِ حَقَّ جِهَادِهِ, and strive hard in the way of Allah as you are to strive for Him. So the verse issues a command in the field of holy struggle with the vast meaning of the word when it says, وَجَاهِدُوا فِي اللَّهِ حَقَّ جِهَادِهِ, and strive hard in Allah as you ought to strive for Him. In this regard, the majority of the Islamic commentators have not taken the concept of holy struggle in this verse in the particular sense of fighting with gun against the enemies and infidels. On the contrary, as it is understood from the lexicographical concept of the word itself, they have considered it with the meaning of any struggle and effort in the way of Allah. For example, like doing benefactions, combating against low desires, which is somehow the jihadul akbar, or the greater warfare. Also, striving against the cruel, unjust enemies is, of course, another instance or case for the meaning of jihad, which is the lesser warfare.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi,
a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The late Tabarsi in Majma' al-Bayan narrates from the majority of the commentators that the purpose of the Quranic phrase حق جهاده وجاهدوا في الله حق جهاده, as you ought to strive for him, is the sincere intention and actually accomplishing the acts for the cause of Allah. Somehow, that خلوص النية, which is having the intention only for the sake of the Almighty Allah. Of course, there is no doubt that the Quranic phrase حق جهاده has a very vast meaning and can envelop all the concepts from the viewpoint of quality, quantity, also somehow place and time and the like of them. And the meaning that we mentioned, of course, does not contradict that. But what the late Tabarsi has mentioned may be because of the fact that the stage of sincerity is the most difficult stage in struggling against oneself. And that's the reason, maybe, why the Holy Quran has emphasized on this stage the penetration of evil thoughts and motivations into man's heart and mind, and even the penetration into the deeds. They are all hidden, narrow, and they are so concealed that none can relieve him from them save the selected servants of the Almighty Allah. So, in these five instructions, in fact, the Holy Quran has begun from the simple stage up to the last and highest stages of servitude. The beginning words are about bowing, and then superior to it, about prostration, and next to it, the statement is about any worship in general. Because the verse says, فَأَقِيمُوا الصَّلَاةَ وَآتُوا الزَّكَاةَ وَاعْتَصِمُوا بِاللَّهِ وَمَوْلَاكُمْ فَنِعْمَ الْمَوْلَى وَنِعْمَ النَّصِيرُ. Therefore, establish prayer and pay the poor rate, hold fast to Allah, He is your guardian, and how excellent the guardian, and how excellent the helper. So, the fulfillment of good deeds, irrespective of the worships and other than them, comes later and in the last stage. The Holy Quran refers to holy struggle and effort and endeavor, whether they are done individually or socially, interior or exterior, and related to behavior, speech, ethics, and intention. So this instruction is conclusive and leads to salvation and prosperity as its consequence. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the seas. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So we've been discussing about the Yemeni war, and we said that the great Satan America, you know, this deceptive, tyrannical, hegemonic regime, has lifted its kind of support for the Saudis to a certain extent, and it's taken Ansarullah, the good guys in Yemen, off the terrorist list. And we said that this is a deceptive move made by America. And a lot of people will fall for this trap. There's a little idea that I have in my head, and I'd like you to expand on it for me. So America has a track record of supporting puppet dictators, and when those dictators outdo their usefulness, they invade the country of that dictator. So we saw this happen in Iraq, for example, where they supported Saddam Hussein. They used Saddam Hussein to attack Iran for 8 years. They supplied him with all sorts of weapons, chemical weapons and intelligence and air support and everything. And then when Saddam Hussein failed, they invaded Iraq. Could it be possible that America is doing a similar thing with the Saudis? Yeah, Sayyid Mehdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, yeah, it's possible that they are. I'm going to let Sheikh Ali give a little bit more detail on that if he wants to. One thing, though, we have to make sure that the foundations here are correct. We're talking about deception and how the American political system, and as Imam Khomeini and Imam Khamenei in the present time, they call them these great idols, they call them the great Satan, because of this deception. Just as a precursor to our discussion here, the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic are based upon divine values, okay? Divine values of justice and, for example, equality and economic justice, social justice, truth, honor, virtue, nobility. This is what the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution is based upon, divine values. And so the political strategy of the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution and the resistance movement, the political strategy is also based upon divine values.
In the words of Imam Khomeini, our politics is our religion is our politics.
Asant. And so it's based on divine values. Now we have to see the other side. We're talking about deception. If you look at the political strategy of the United States of America and most of the Western countries, you will see that they adhere to something called political realism. And so this ideology or this philosophy of political realism comes from this Machiavellian ideology. I don't know if you ever heard about this, but this is a guy in Italy who he set out certain rules on how you control the people and how you run a government, right? So this political realism, which your liberals in the United States and conservatives in the United States, hawks or chickens, all of them, deep down inside, they believe in political realism, which is what? It is to do what is in your own best interest and destroy the opposition by any means necessary for your own interest.
SubhanAllah, that's fascinating.
Right? This is what
This actually makes perfect sense, because whenever you talk to somebody about politics, they always have a negative view of it, especially in the English-speaking world. It's because of the Machiavellian kind of presentation of what politics is.
Yeah, and this philosophy, you know, and you hear this. We've gotten so used to of hearing all this that they say it was in our national interest, right? It was collateral damage, right? All of these terms are, as a matter of fact, a manifestation of this very philosophical ideology of how to run and operate and how to, execute our strategy and our policy to meet those ends. And this is where you hear many of them saying it and many of others practically manifesting it. What do they do? Ends justify the means.
Yes, right.
It's for the greater cause. These are the things that you end up hearing in the Western philosophy and in their politics.
Let me just finish. So what happens is in this political realism, so then war, economic terrorism, right, sanctions, creating terrorists such as Al-Qaeda, creating terrorists such as Daesh, labeling people who aren't terrorists to be terrorists, like Al-Mustafa International University, for example, putting on financial sanctions, and deception is all part of this plan. It's right. all part of this philosophy. And this is what you see the United States doing. So whether they put Ansarullah on the terrorist list or they take it off of the terrorist list, it is only and only because of their own self-interests.
And I think it's very precise. Mm-hmm. If you look at this whole phenomena, mm-hmm. and which we alluded to before in the previous talk show, and Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, he talked about this too. Why are we skeptical? Because America has a track record, right? The Zionist regime has a track record. These Western countries, UK, France, they all have a track record yeah. of looking out for their self-interest only. Right, which they call it to be their national interest. It turns out that it's not even a national interest, to be honest. Yeah. You know, it's the interest of that 1% or even less.
Right, exactly. Right?
So this is exactly why they have taken them off the terrorist list. I have an analysis which I'm kind of refraining and avoiding because I haven't read on that enough. They knew that these sanctions are not going to be effective. So here I just said it, right?
Yeah, right.
See, once you know that the sanctions are not effective, this means they have lost a tool.
Right.
They have lost a manipulating tool from their hand that they thought is going to be effective. It turned out, okay, it's not going to be effective in case of Yemen. So as a matter of fact, people are going to think that our sanctions are not effective. This means it's our strength that is going to be challenged.
Uh-huh.
So just so to
for
save
psychological
their,
reasons,
exactly.
They need.
That's one of the dimensions uh-huh. that I feel it has also a role to play in these sanctions to be taken.
Because
off.
Usually, when America says no, people say okay.
Exactly.
Right? And then if America's saying no, and somebody just be like.
And do you know one thing really interesting to go off of your point? Ansarullah celebrated after they were put on the sanctions list. They were put on this terrorist list and they celebrated. Why? Because they are defining it to be a source of pride for them instead of a source of, nung and awe and shamefulness, right?
Yeah.
So they said that this is something which we are proud of, that the great Satan has put us on a sanctions list. You know, this means we are the party of Allah. We are the ones who are the group of Allah, the party of Allah, who is struggling in His way for justice, for that human values that every nation looks forward to. What do you know about Yemen, right? If you look at last 6 years at least, you know, Yemen is known to be that hub of resistance against the Saudi and U.S.-led wars in the region, especially on Yemen. Right?
Yeah.
So they have been resisting. Like I said before, Saudi and America, in their calculation, it was only going to be a matter of a few days before Yemen falls. Before the resistance movement there just gives up, you know, they kneel down and they start like bowing in front of America and Saudis the way they wish to. Turned out, no. These people, these dignified people, the nation, and it's not just a group. When we say Ansarullah, it's like a widespread phenomena in Yemen, you know. It's every other person is Ansarullah, right?
Yeah.
They
right.
stood tall. They resisted against the oppression. They resisted to make sure, and if you look at the speeches of Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, who is the leader of the Ansarullah movement, you look at his speeches, it is so beautiful. He's reciting Quran, and he's like, you know, we are the misdaq of this verse of Quran. We are going to stand in front of the oppressors. We're not going to give in to the oppressors. Even if we are completely annihilated, we are not going to let this history be made that the nations, they give in to the whims and wishes of the great Satan and, you know, regimes, rogue regimes like Saudi Arabia. So, alhamdulillah, you know, it's resistance and their whole slogans, you know, it starts with Allahu Akbar, you know, and it ends with, you know, with the death of the Zionists, right?
Yeah.
So, alhamdulillah, you know, it's the resistance that is standing tall. It's not just a nation, it's not just a country. And they're paying a price for that resistance.
They are.
Right? It's nothing else. It's for that resistance.
I want to bring it back.
Before we do, see, so this resistance that we're talking about here, one of the things that we have to factor in here is that these are people, you know, the Ansarullah movement, who represents a large majority of the Yemeni people, is conducting this movement or this resistance in order for their voices to be heard, right? So what I'm saying is that during the time of Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was put in there by the colonial powers, and then the second guy, he's got a weird name. I keep on messing it up, but this guy, Mansour Rabi something. So this guy, who was the one who fled to Saudi Arabia,
yeah.
And then Saudi Arabia did this war in order to try to bring him back, right? This guy was taken out during when? During the Arab Spring, the Islamic Spring.
Mm-hmm.
When the Islamic Spring happened, the Houthis and the Ansarullah movement and a large majority of the Yemeni people stood up for their democratic rights,
yeah.
Which had been, they had been under oppression during this guy, Abu Mansur, and Ali Abdullah Saleh.
Yeah.
Okay? So when these guys stood up for their rights, their self-determination, their democracy, this is when the Americans and the Saudis and all these guys put them down.
Wow. So, okay? I'm having a bit of deja vu here. So we've seen this happen before. This kind of revolution against a puppet dictator, we saw it happen in 1979 in Iran, right? So these people of Iran, they rose up and they overthrew the dictator. What was the next move that America made? It supported Saddam Hussein to attack Iran.
Mm.
And then after years of fighting with Iran, they failed to overcome Iran, and then America invaded Iraq. So I'm coming right back to the original question here, because I wanted to throw that at Sheikh Ali and see what he has to say about it. Is this something similar that we're seeing now? Because the people of Yemen have now risen up. They have also overthrown their dictator. America has done the same thing, backing not Saddam Hussein this time, but the Saudi regime to attack them. And they're also failing. So when they prove that they have no power against the Yemenis, is America going to invade Saudi Arabia?
Well, I'll come to the Saudi Arabia part at the end, but trust me, it's the same execution strategy that the West always has.
Mm. And fails.
It is.
So
and it always fails, right? With the the cap of resistance always fails. It is the strategy of carrot and stick. They tried to use mm-hmm. a stick against Yemenis to crush them, you know, uh-huh. because it's a quicker way, you know, mm-hmm. simply it's just easier, it's quicker. And it's less consuming.
They saw the Yemenis had a bigger stick than they
yeah.
did.
It turned out that Yemenis, you know, gave them a proper pushback, right?
Yeah.
And they're not backing off from their dignified stance.
Hmm.
Now, Trump goes, Biden comes in, they have a new strategy that we are going to go to the route of diplomacy. And in order for you to be in diplomatic terms with a country's main representative body, in this case, Ansarullah, they can't be on a terrorist list. You can't really
right.
negotiate. So I think where it's headed, and we will see as things unfold, I think they're going to take it towards diplomacy, and what they're going to do there is, okay, you've got a humanitarian crisis. You don't have clean water. You don't have medicines. You don't have, your crops are gone. Your buildings are, your infrastructure is, you know. Okay, we will build it all for you.
Mm.
We will come help you. We'll provide you. United Nations will come in. You know, we'll provide you with medicines. We'll provide you with all this stuff. You know, let's sit down, have a talk. And we'll give you cash to run the country, right? We'll give you money. You know, we'll help you get the oil thing at your disposal so you can export. You know, we'll give you all these facilities. We will, in other words, facilitate you, uplift you, right? For what? For giving up on your revolutionary and the stance of resistance and coming out of the camp of resistance, which is led by the Islamic Republic of Iran and Wilaya. They want them to just leave that camp. First they tried the stick, now they're going to try the carrot. But let me assure you, as much as I have studied Yemenis and as much as I know about them, they don't stand a chance to have any victory in this diplomatic negotiations either, if they go down that route.
That's all we have time for today. We hope you enjoyed and benefited from the show. Inshallah, we'll see you next time. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
European News Bulletin.
Here in London, news with me, Saeed Bourizza. A major development in this country today, and that has to do with the Supreme Court that has ruled that Shamima Begum, a 21-year-old woman who left the UK for Syria 6 years ago to join Daesh, should not be allowed back into the country to pursue an appeal against the removal of her British citizenship. Many argue that refusing to repatriate her could backfire, but the government insists she is a security risk. Bianca Rahimi tells us more.
In July 2020, the Court of Appeal ruled that Shamima Begum should be allowed to return to the UK to challenge her citizenship being revoked, saying it was, quote, the only way in which she can have a fair and effective appeal. But in November, the Home Office appealed against the decision, arguing it would create significant national security risks. Now the Supreme Court has ruled in the Home Office's favour, saying the right to a fair hearing does not trump other considerations.
The appropriate response to the problem in the present case is for the deprivation appeal to be stayed or postponed until Ms. Begum is in a position to play an effective part in it without public safety being compromised. That is not a perfect solution, as it's not known how long it may be before that is possible. But there is no perfect solution to a dilemma at the present time.
In February 2015, at the age of 15, Shamima Begum left the UK for Syria. She was then found in 2019 in a Syrian refugee camp with other women and their children. The interviews that she gave made headline news and sparked heated debates. In what many called a publicity stunt, then Home Secretary Sajid Javid stripped Ms. Begum of her citizenship. Before the latest ruling, four British MPs wrote in the Telegraph that leaving British Daesh members in an ungoverned space would backfire on the UK.
If they are judged to be a risk, then all the more reason why they should be returned to Britain, where they can be processed by the British criminal justice system. Many of the people involved travelled to Syria as teenagers after being groomed online or trafficked by organised ISIS gangs.
France has outsourced its Daesh members' prosecutions to Iraq, where they have been given death sentences. The UK, the US, Ireland and Australia have stripped the accused of their citizenships. According to the Middle East Institute, this might be fueling future terrorist activity by sending the message that they are second-class citizens, particularly those with immigrant backgrounds. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Well, let's discuss that story with Ahmed Caballo. Ahmed, good to have you. What do you make of this decision made by the Supreme Court, which essentially, as we heard in our report, upholds the Home Office's argument that allowing her to return to the UK would, quote, create significant national security risk?
Yeah, it's worrying and it sets a dangerous precedent, because the decision today wasn't about her British citizenship per se, but more about the right to a fair trial. Because they claim in the UK that the right to a fair trial is a cornerstone of any democracy, and something the UK lambasts other nations around the world about. Yet the Supreme Court decided to overturn the Court of Appeal and said that the only way forward was to allow her to have her case while being in a refugee camp in northern Syria, Now, no one could argue that she could rightfully defend herself or appropriately defend herself from a refugee camp, which is most likely still controlled by the same elements that she was that she joined in the first place. Now, what's interesting about the decision is that it claims to be about national security, but if Shamim Begum returned to the UK, then she would most likely be monitored. She would be under house arrest. She'd be intensely watched. She'd have limited visitation rights. So in my opinion, it wasn't really about national security, but a political decision, because there was very little appetite to allow her back into the UK. And the other real issue is that because of the relatively low conviction rate for fighters and their spouses who return to the UK, because the defence who represent these fighters are able to argue that the groups that these fighters join were also part of the same groups that have been supported by the British state itself, and therefore it wouldn't make sense to convict these fighters of crimes or fighting on behalf of a cause that the British state itself has supported.
All right, I mean, let's bring in race and ethnicity into the conversation as well. What role, if any, do you think those two facts, if you will, have played in the way that Shamima Begum has been treated by the government here?
I think it's played a massive role, because if you're a British citizen from an ethnic minority background here in the UK, there is this perception that your citizenship is conditional, and that if you criticise the British state, criticise British foreign policy, criticise British domestic policy such as policing, stop and search, then a common response is, why don't you go back to where you came from, negating the fact that if you are born in the UK, you are a British citizen. And I think this underpins the Shamim Begum case, because the idea is her citizenship was conditional, and therefore when she did something that the British public and British MPs and the British Home Office didn't like, then she no longer becomes a British citizen. But that negates the fact that British citizens commit heinous crimes abroad all the time. They are not stripped of their British citizenship. They're usually punished under the eyes of the law, and I think many people, legal observers, would argue that's what should have happened to Shamima Begum.
All right. Do you think that the British state, perhaps, is trying to wash their hands off Shamima Begum and not trying to understand instead the reasons why a child born and raised in the UK, as you mentioned, could be radicalized enough to go and join a terrorist group halfway around the world?
Yes, certainly. I mean, she was groomed in the UK. Her school was notified. The British police knew what was happening, yet very little action was taken. And now, ultimately, many people are arguing that she has to take responsibility for her actions, but so should the British state in their failure to protect this young girl who left at the age of 15 to join Daesh. And that, yes, she should be punished. Yes, she should face the heavy hand of the law if she's found to have broken laws. But she should do that as a British citizen, because she committed those crimes as a British citizen. She was born and raised in the UK, and under international law, you cannot classify someone as stateless. And Bangladesh has stated very clearly that she's not a Bengali citizen.
She indeed is not. And also, that called into question the efficacy of the controversial so-called PREVENT program as well.
For sure, because if there are radicalization signs, then how could a 15-year-old get a passport and travel to a war zone? It shows that the PREVENT system or program isn't fit for purpose, and it isn't actually doing the very thing that it's designed to do, which is to stop the radicalization of young people and people in general in the UK. And I think there needs to be a further discussion about the role of the British state in supporting Takfiri militant groups in Syria, which has meant that there is a relatively low conviction rate for when these fighters come back. And that's the real issue. They're worried that the if Shamima Begum does return back to the UK, it's going to be very difficult to convict her while the UK has supported similar groups in Syria to overthrow Bashar al-Assad.
All right, thanks for your insight into the story, Ahmed Caballo there. Thank you. Moving on now. One person has died and four others have been wounded in a U.S. military air raid against anti-terror forces operating on the Iraqi Syria border. The attack took place in the early hours of the morning in eastern Syria against Iraq's popular mobilization units who have been fighting against the Takfiri Daesh terror group. Washington said that U.S. President Biden authorized the strikes in an attempt to de-escalate the overall situation in both eastern Syria and Iraq. Russia has condemned the attack, which was the first of its kind under President Biden, labeling it dangerous and illegal. Staying with the Biden administration, it has said it'll soon reveal details of how it will take action against those responsible for the murder of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
He's been very clear that the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, it was a horrific crime. That, of course, is going to be at the center of the report that we have been speaking to. This was enshrined in legislation that the administration should provide an unclassified version of the report to Congress.
The news comes days after The Guardian reported that U.S. President Joe Biden plans to release an unclassified intelligence report that will likely incriminate Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the brutal killing of Khashoggi. The long-awaited report is expected to strain U.S.-Saudi ties. EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell has urged world leaders to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal.
I am convinced, as coordinator of the JCPOA, that we do have a diplomatic space, a diplomatic window of opportunity to dialogue at this moment and to reinvigorate this deal according with the wish explained and expressed by the new Biden administration. We need to use this opportunity and focus on solutions to bring the JCPOA back on track in order for everybody fulfilling their commitments. This is an occasion that we cannot miss.
Mr. Borrell was speaking at an EU meeting held in Brussels, which was attended by European leaders and NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. His comments come just days after Iran said that it would comply with its full JCPOA requirements once all signatories to the agreement show strict compliance as well. Greece and Austria are urging other EU states to adopt coronavirus vaccination passports, which they claim will help revive the struggling tourism industry whilst preventing the spread of the coronavirus. Leaders of the EU's 27 countries met online Thursday to start a two-day summit to discuss the ongoing pandemic and vaccination certificates. If approved, the vaccination passport would allow people who have been vaccinated with both jabs to travel within EU member states. In Greece, where tourism contributes to 25% of the annual GDP, global COVID-19 lockdown restrictions have destroyed the economy. Back in this country, Queen Elizabeth II of Britain has encouraged people living in the UK to, quote, think of others and get vaccinated against the coronavirus.
I think the other thing is that it is obviously difficult for people to, if they've never had a vaccine, because they ought to think about other people rather than themselves.
Her comments come after statistics reveal that 11 to 15% of British people were reluctant to get the COVID-19 vaccine, with many citing lack of trust in the authorities. So far, the UK has given more than 18 million people a first vaccine dose, with the government stating it plans to inoculate the rest of the population with their first jab by the summer. Over to Scotland now, where former First Minister Alex Salmond says the country's leadership has acted illegally and must be held to account. Today, he testified in Holyrood with inquiry into the SNP government's botched investigation of sexual harassment claims made against him. Mr. Salmond claims in its inquiry, the committee was systematically deprived of the evidence. He was later acquitted of 13 charges of sexual assault and awarded a payout of upwards of £500,000. But he says Nicola Sturgeon's government must explain why the case was handled so poorly. Have a listen.
The independence of the Crown Office as acting in the public interest matters. Acting in accordance with legal advice matters. Concealing evidence from the courts matters. The duty of candor of public authorities matters. Democratic accountability through parliament matters.
As there is not a shred of evidence that there was a conspiracy against Mr. Salmond and denies lying to parliament, she is scheduled to appear before the committee to give evidence next Wednesday, and we'll be sure to cover that for you. To Italy now. The country has, for the first time in over 6 weeks, recorded its highest daily toll of COVID-19 cases. On Wednesday, Italy registered nearly 16,500 coronavirus cases, raising the country's known total cases to over 2.8 million. Thus far, the country has recorded nearly 97,000 deaths, the highest in Europe after the UK. The news comes just a day. Italian Health Minister Roberta Speranza announced that the country will not be relaxing its strict COVID-19 restrictions until at least April the 6th.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
In this segment, as we have been discussing, he has been president for just over a month, and Joe Biden has now ordered the first military strike of his presidency on, quote, Iranian-backed militia. Now, Washington claims the strike is a response to rocket attacks on U.S. forces in the region in the past 2 weeks. Joining me now to discuss all that, Richard Sudan. And Richard, bring us your take on that story.
I mean, I think it's quite extraordinary in many ways. You know, the sort of press releases and the talking points that are coming out of the Pentagon and Washington are framing this as some kind of retaliatory response, when I think, honestly, most sort of critical thinkers and serious political analysts understand that the United States is the most serious provocateur of violence in the region, not just in recent years, but actually over many, many decades. The U.S. has committed so many violations of sovereignty, so many violations of human rights, and so many war crimes, according to experts, that probably even the most serious mathematicians are probably struggling to keep count. And I think this is just kind of the latest in that series. And I think, you know, the other thing is, let's not forget, you had kind of many liberal pundits and many kind of media outlets across the world really kind of hailing President Joe Biden as some kind of libertarian. Many were making much of his so-called change in rhetoric, this kind of diplomatic tone that he was striking. And I think many people are now just going to see this as business as usual from the United States. You know, the United States' aggressive policy towards Syria and many other areas in the region simply is not going to change with the change of political, you know, office in the Oval Office. And I think, you know, these airstrikes are kind of just underscoring that reality. But I'm afraid I really don't see these as being the last, you know, airstrikes. These have been talked about as the first. And we're literally weeks, you know, into Joe Biden's presidency. So I think hopefully a lot of people would now kind of see the political reality for what it is. And I think also it's interesting that the United States, as it always does, has sought to blame Iran, when most serious observers of Middle Eastern politics actually review the Islamic Republic of Iran as having a massively stabilizing, you know, influence in the region.
And
were it not for
two things to be pointed out here. Number one, Iran denied any involvement in any attack on the U.S. forces that the Americans claim that happened recently. And secondly, it's always been the position of Iran that U.S. and by extension Western military interference in the Middle East region does not really lead to stability. And we have seen over the past decade, two decades I would say, and not even mentioning what happened prior to that, that it's gone from bad to worse. Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan are the most recent examples.
Most people would say these are the facts. You know, we've probably lost track of just how many terrorist groups, cells, and militias have been unleashed off the back of disastrous, failed, repeated policies from the US, of course, backed with their allies like the United States. But I think the reality is the situation in Syria, the situation in Palestine, and all across the region will be vastly different were it not for the stabilizing influence of Iran, which is actually welcomed and celebrated by many. So I think, actually, many people really see the claim by the US and the US government that Iran is somehow to blame for this as actually ludicrous. You know, the facts speak for themselves. Iran has not been involved in any wars against anybody, but it's the United States that is continually making excuse after excuse to go into other people's countries, many people would say primarily to get resources. And of course, let's not forget that, you know, the arms industry, the war industry, is a massive industry which rakes in billions and billions of dollars in profit each year. And so, you know, observers would say the United States needs to keep making excuses for meddling in other countries. And in this case, we're talking about airstrikes in Syria. But, you know, Saeed, I think more and more people are starting really to cotton on to the kind of reality of the situation.
Bring us some of the reaction to this story online.
And there have been many. Let's go first to Danny, who says, Biden has bombed Syria, blaming it on an Iranian-backed militia targeting military hardware in Iraq. Could it be that the people of the region want the U.S. occupiers to leave? Biden's rule will be riddled with war crimes, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. Birthday Sprinkle says President Biden bombed Syria before Americans got COVID relief payments, and it's not even surprising. And Tanner Jones tweeted, Joe Biden just bombed Syria, so I think now is a good time to say again that the U.S. should not be in the Middle East at all. And there's many reactions like this online at the moment, Saeed.
All right, Richard, let's move on to your second story. And while we're still in Syria, we're going to revisit a story I discussed with Ahmed Caballo earlier on in the broadcast. Tell us how social media users have reacted to today's ruling by the British Supreme Court on the case of Shamima Begum.
Well, I think it's really hard to overstate the significance of this case, which really isn't about Shamima Begum herself. This is about a much wider issue. And I think one of the primary points here for many people is that, you know, Britain calls itself a democracy. Many people say it's the kind of mother of democracies. But Shamima Begum was basically tried in the media and by right-wing populism before she even had a day in court. Now, no one is saying that Shamima Begum shouldn't be held accountable for her actions. But, you know, the United Kingdom, and again, this is not me, this is legal observers and legal experts saying this, the United Kingdom cannot simply render people stateless for politically expedient reasons. It simply cannot be the case. Now, I dare say this decision will probably be appealed, but I think what's astonishing for a lot of people is that the justification given for this is that Shamima Begum somehow presents a national security threat. This is a 21-year-old woman who left the country when she was 15 years old. It's not like she went to join Daesh as a fighter. She married a Daesh fighter, and I think it's ridiculous that she now constitutes some kind of serious threat to national security when we see many other umpteen examples of people that have been involved in wars involving terrorism, people would say. And not only that, I think year after year, the United Kingdom basically rolls out the red carpet to all sorts of arms dealers involved in very real war crimes abroad. And actually, other leaders, for example, the Israeli leaders are welcomed here, you know, with red carpet. So I think this is really about a much wider issue, much wider, way beyond Shamima Begum. And as I think Ahmed Caballo said, this certainly sets a dangerous precedent. But again, a lot of legal experts are basically agreeing with that point. And
Richard,
I think
let me get your opinion on this point briefly as well. Some are calling this ruling, this whole treatment of Shamima Begum, as a cynical distraction from a failed counterterror strategy. Very briefly, what do you think of that?
Well, I think even if it isn't a direct ploy to do that, it will certainly have that effect. And by the way, it won't just divert attention from a failed, you know, kind of a foreign policy strategy. It will divert from a whole host of other problems in the United Kingdom. I think one of the points here is everyone's focusing on Shamima Begum. I think many more people are actually saying, look, what is the UK's role, or what was the UK's role in actually bringing about the emergence of Daesh? Many people are saying that the United Kingdom and her allies through failed foreign policies, have created the fertile breeding ground which allows terror groups like Daesh to flourish. And so if that hadn't happened, there would have been no Daesh for Shamima Begum to go to in 2015. So I think
that
all of this really diverts responsibility
point,
from the United Kingdom.
Indeed. Let's hear from people out there who have been watching this story.
Trevor tweets, Andrew Mitchell, the journalist, is correct. Of course, Shamima Begum and the other British nationals should be returned to the UK and their citizenship restored. They are nationals and should be tried in the UK. Gary Young, the journalist, tweets an old article of his on the subject, which says, the notion that Britain could not handle Shamima Begum, could not show her a better future, could not try her, convict her, reorient her, or support her, is worse than pathetic. And Dragon tweets, Shamima Begum was an actual child when she was groomed and radicalized. The decision to strip her of her citizenship is so wrong, and I wonder how different it would be if she was white. And Dragon's not the only person to make that final point there, Saeed.
All right, Richard Sudan. Richard, thanks for all of that. Our time is literally up. Thanks for joining us again.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah.
Leadership from the perspective of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini speaks about the model of leadership. In the early days of Islam, a government whose Wali al-Amr was equal to the simplest citizen living there before the law. It happened in the government of the early Islam. In this regard, there is a story about Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam. During his rule, which was extended to include the Arab Peninsula, Egypt, Iran, and many other areas, while it was he who was assigning judges, an individual from Yemen, living under the control of this very government, brought a lawsuit against the Imam, and the judge summoned Imam Ali alayhi salam. When Imam alayhi salam arrived in the court, the judge tried to show respect for him. Although the judge was really appointed by Amir al-Mu'mineen himself, Imam said, while judging, do not respect only one party. He and I should be equal. And after the judge issued a rule against Imam Ali, he accepted it cheerfully.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, we are here with another episode of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. And I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini. We were talking about his viewpoints in regards to the religion of Islam. In this speech, or this part of speech, Imam has said that Islam has come to purify mankind. Now, we all know that in the Quran, Allah said that I have completed the religion. Al-yawm akmaltu lakum dinakum. At the day of Ghadir, the Prophet ﷺ has announced a verse that was revealed on him by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in which Allah said that today we have completed the religion. Watmamtu alaykum ni'mati, and we have finished all the blessings upon you. Now, because we know that the religion of Islam is the complete religion.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.